And good evening and welcome to the Happy Recap Radio Show. I am EJ Stankwitz, your host, and we're just hoping to hear from JB any minute. And happy 4th of July to everybody. And I believe we have you right there. What's up, JB?
Not much. That's one of those things you just don't expect to have, right when you expect to hear the kindly lady saying Blog Talk Radio, to hear little tone saying you've been disconnected.
Yeah, I guess I thought we had all the gremlins out of the machine from last week, but hopefully that's our one blip of the day.
I'm hoping so. I mean, you know, certainly our, it's just par for the course. As go the Mets, seem to be as go our technical difficulties.
Very true, very true. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good. How was your fourth?
It was excellent. Barbecue, time with the family, time with good friends. The only thing that you really ask for more is to watch some great baseball, and unfortunately, I struck out on that end.
Yeah, I think we have to watch a different team at this point if we want to see some great baseball. My fourth, not too bad. A little surreal with the breaking news story yesterday involving Steve McNair, and certainly sympathies go out to his family with that whole thing. It's just a bizarre, bizarre situation, and you know, inordinately sad from the world of football yesterday.
Yeah, no question about it. And actually, you were the first person I thought of because I know that you have been a Titans fan for the longest time, and you're the first person I texted when I heard the news, and that is tragic. And everyone at the Happy Recap, our thoughts and prayers go out to the McNair family, and hope they get through this rough time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And turning back to the team we talk about, the New York Mets, not much you could say about the past week, really, dropping 2-3 to Milwaukee. Go in and take one from the lowly Pirates, despite the fact that Mr. LaRoche still had a little bit of something to say, albeit with his bat, not with his mouth this time. And then we go into Philadelphia, and, Philadelphia swept 3 from the Buffalo Bisons this weekend, let's put it that way. And yet again today we have a situation where Johan goes out, basically pitches a pretty stinking good game, albeit, two of the three hits he allows, leave the ballpark, but certainly, for a left-hander in Citizens Bank Ballpark, that's not half bad. And yet, of course, the Mets cannot seem to rustle up any run support whatsoever and manage to walk away, not only scoring Zippo today, but a total of 3 runs over the entire freaking weekend.
Yeah, it's as ugly as it gets right now. I mean, Johan, he basically had 2 mistakes today, and unfortunately, they both ended up leaving the ballpark, but that's the situation we're in now, where these pitchers are going out there every day feeling like, basically, if you give up, if you have that one mistake, then that could probably doom you for the day, the way this offense is going. And, I mean, if you need any other indication, I was figuring out before, 16-0. That's what the Mets have been trailing over the course of the last 4 games. Starting with the losing 5-0, they were down 5-0 in the start of that Pirates game, which, of course, they ultimately did come back from. And then all weekend in Philly, they ended up going down 11-0 to start those games. And when you're playing catch-up the entire game, it just seems like eventually it's going to come back and bite you, and it did. And
well,
we ended up seeing the result.
You can't play catch-up the whole game. That's not winning baseball. I mean, if that's all you can do is catch-up, you're going to run out of second chances at some point. I mean, even Steve Howe ran out of chances at some point. It happens. You're going to run out of chances, and you just cannot play. I mean, it's like pitching. You cannot consistently pitch behind in the count. You're going to get dinged for it.
No question. And even this team at 100% health wouldn't be able to play the comeback game the way that they're asking the current team that we have assembled to play it. And, I mean, these guys just really aren't – none of them are good enough to do that. And really, it just – I'm getting sick. I'm really getting tired of this team. And I know they can't help the injuries. But again, and I'm sick of saying it every single week, the fundamentals of baseball should be there from anybody playing any brand of professional baseball, whether it's at the lowest of A-ball or it's at the major league level. You should be able to run the bases. You should be able to make simple cutoff plays. And just do the lay down a bunt, the fundamental things of baseball, and it's really that's the only word for it. It's sickening right now, the brand of ball that this Mets team is playing.
Well, and it's like it's a complete. I mean, I am one of the more optimistic Met fans out there. I recognize this, and I'm all right with that because I think sometimes you just need to be optimistic, or you'll run your head into a wall. But this so far goes beyond the capabilities of you gotta believe that I can't even put it into words because I simply don't. As a fan, I see 2-0 down. I see a loss already. And I have never been that way as a Met fan, ever. I mean, this team has never put me through this before in that way. I have never sat there and gone down to 3-0 and after one, crap, this one's over.
Absolutely.
But that's exactly how I feel right now. And a one-run lead feels like tenuous, and being down by one run feels like we're never going to even get to that point. Scoring one run seems to be a challenge for this team.
Bro, I fully agree. In fact, even today, if you follow the Happy Recap on Twitter, you'll see that I posted at 1-0. Why does 1-0 feel more like 100-0 at this point? And you're right. That's exactly where it is. I have no faith whatsoever in this team. The only way I thought we were going to have a shot today would be if we scratched out one or two early and then Johan went to work and he did what Johan does. And unfortunately, it was just the opposite. They scratched out the run, and I knew it. 1-0, I was feeling doomed. And I'm sick of being able to predict negativity with the Mets. But when David Wright gets up with the bases loaded in the sixth inning, down one zip, we had a live chat going on, and I posted, why do I have a bad feeling we're about to see a game-ending double play here, despite it only being the sixth inning. Sure enough, ground out the second, and that's a Mets' real last legitimate scoring opportunity all day. And I'm just sick of it. I'm fed up with this team, and I'm as angry as I've been at them in a very, very long time. And it's not a good place to be. I mean, basically, like you said, you're the positive fan. I've always kind of been given the stigma as something of a negative fan. I have won that award twice in a row on the happyrecap.com. And I made a concerted effort this year to really try to have a more positive outlook about this team. And there's nothing to be positive about. Anytime I get amped up about anything, it seems like it goes away. I was psyched for Fernando Martinez to come up. Well, guess what? He's now got an injury on the back of his knee. I'm psyched to see guys like Danny Murphy progress. Instead, they're regressing. And I'm fed up, I'm sick, and I want to see something change. What it is, I don't know.
Well, and I don't know either, because the biggest problem I have right now is I as a fan, I desperately want to point a finger and go, you did this. And I really can't. I mean, you know, certainly you can fault Omar Minaya for how he built this team. The problem is a lot of the players that are getting hurt are the younger players. How you can't go, well, gee, Omar put together a team of 40-year-olds. Well, no, he didn't. In fact, the one 40-year-old he brought in is probably the best player on the team so far this year. You know, so, I mean, and you know, you can point your finger, well, it's Ray Ramirez. Oh, my gosh. Well, he's not telling these guys to go out and get hurt. I mean, yeah, probably there's some culpability there. But really, in the middle of a season, what good does firing your trainer do? Squat diddly. I mean, and the fundamentals, well, you know, sometimes you just can't, I mean, you just can't teach them. I mean, maybe that means there needs to be some changes on the coaching staff. But again, there's no quick fix there except, maybe you have to look at the guy that I've started calling Chuckles. And that's Jerry Manuel, because every time there seems to be a problem, all he does is chuckle about it. And, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit later in the game, in the show, I should say. Certainly I think that one of the big problems this team has is there are so many problems that there is so little and so much blame to go around that you can't you can't figure out, you know, where to put that blame because there's so much of it. There's so many people to look at, and there's so little places you can actually assess that blame.
No question. And, of course, the number one thing that people are going to say about the 2009 campaign is they're going to just bring up the injuries over and over again. But like I said, and as you just mentioned yourself, when it comes to things like fundamentals, I mean, that's got to come from the top. If there is really this attitude that I think many fans, not just myself, has, that this team basically has a team-wide attitude of almost just not caring and not playing the game the way it's supposed to be played, then that's got to be a change that we have to discuss making at the top, because who is allowing that entire attitude to run rampant through the clubhouse?
Absolutely, and I think, you know, even I think it was David Lennon who had said on his Twitter earlier today that, talking about 4th of July barbecues today, that Jerry Manuel said that he hadn't been to more than two or three over the last 20 years, although at this pace, he may be at one next year. So, I mean, I think even he sees the handwriting on the wall that something has to turn around, because unfortunately that old baseball adage comes true. You can't fire the players.
Yeah, and while good I for certainly Jerry. Don't think he's working on still working on his stand up, so at least all the beat reporters got a good chuckle out of Jerry then.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, that's why I'm starting to call the boy Chuckles. I mean, it just seems like, you know, gallows humor is his wine of the day. But speaking of wine, let's get off our whining soapboxes here. Let's change gears a little bit and maybe calm down a little before we head towards the end of the show and talk about it some more. But we want to head out to our guest who's joining us. And today we've got Matt Silverman joining us. And guy's written quite a few books about the Mets over the years, and we're glad to have him joining us. His two most recent books include 100 Things Mets Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. And let's face it, most of us Met fans will feel like dying might be this year, so it's a good book to get started on right away. And this year he teamed up with Keith Hernandez on his recollections of the final season at Shea Stadium, titled Shea Goodbye, The Untold Inside Story of the Historic 2008 Season. He joins us to talk about these books, both published by Triumph, as well as to generally talk some Mets baseball with us. And I want to thank him for taking some time out. Matt Silverman, how are you today?
I'm doing well. I have to say I've been a bit oblivious the last couple of days about the Mets, but you know, all I needed to do was I was just stuck on the New York Thruway. Just had to, you know, turn on the fan for about 5 minutes and like pretty much figure out exactly what happened. I knew they lost yesterday, but didn't have a good feeling about today, and I still don't know a score, but you know, I feel like it is a rerun that I've seen before.
It's
Sir Jerry Kuzman instead of Johan Santana or something like that.
Yeah, Santana gave up two bombs, led for 2-0 score, and that was it. They couldn't even get him a run's worth of support. Otherwise, Santana pitched perfectly well today, one of his better starts in the last month, and again, they couldn't even scratch across a run.
Yeah, they, you know, it's just hard to figure out this team. I mean, they should, by all rights, they should be 14 games out, and the way they're playing, it won't be long before they get there.
Yeah, I had thought when we had our show last week, I had said the possibility existed by this Sunday that we could be 7-8 out, and surprisingly didn't get there, but sure getting close and sure getting fast. Well, we'd definitely appreciate you taking the time out with us. Let's start off by talking about the 100 Things Mets Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. This book is like the perfect book for if you're a diehard fan to hand to somebody you basically got in training, and you know, probably hard to train a Mets fan right about now, but. Where did the idea come to put together a book like this?
Well, I have to admit the publisher came to me and asked me, but it was the first, you know, the Mets, a rarity, the Mets were the first in a series of books that they've since done it for a bunch of other teams, and really it was fun to be able to, you know, they had the idea of the 100 things. But it actually changed several times the way they wanted to do it. They wanted to break it into like 10 different categories and rank it that way until the very end. And then we switched it to 1 through 100, which threw me for a loop because, you know, there's like a few things I had left out. And then it was like, you know, studying for a Mets final, you know, that your entire grade depended on. And I'm trying to, you know, get this in and figure out where this ranks in terms of that. And then after I'd handed everything in, they had a wonderful I guess you call it a collapse. It's kind of hard to even rate them. I guess collapse one against the Phillies that I had to, like a punish assignment, write the day after the season ended in 2007.
Ouch.
Yeah, that was pretty tough. And, you know, I was looking at the rankings, and as a result, originally I had David Wright and Jose Reyes, you know, neck and neck, you know, as in terms of the ranking, and I had to move some stuff around, and I was so annoyed at Reyes, I realized that I had moved him like 20 spots back because I guess I held him probably more responsible than Ryan. He did really not play well down the line. And I was looking at it the other day. I was like, wow, that probably was a little unfair. But I tried to be as professional as I could with it. But and I didn't. Only I think "damn" was the worst word I used in there. But and I also ranked the 30th because you know, Mets fans are so instant that you're like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened or the best thing that's ever happened. But I tried to use some hindsight that, and especially compared to what's happened the last couple of years, 30 is probably about right.
Definitely.
All the things
that's
happened
to
them.
I think that was pretty accurate, dead on as to where you ranked them. And what was the process like for you as far as, A, coming up with the 100 and then, B, actually ranking them? How did you go about that process?
Well, I think if I'd done 1 through 100 with, well, because they have you put the verb do in there. So, that kind of threw me for a loop. And originally we had an entire section just on Shea Stadium. And I decided since it was going into the last year at Shea that I would, I had all this really useless, information about Shea Stadium and how I got around there and had, gone from the upper deck to the lower deck for years. They made it harder toward the end. But you could still go from the upper deck to the loge, without a whole lot of problem. You just had to stay like one step ahead of the ushers or the people who got up from their seats and stuff like that. And so I included a lot of things there and ranked each, not necessarily ranked, but talked about each level and my favorite seat in each level. And some other stuff like that, and that was a lot of fun. So that I did 87 to 100, and then I threw in a couple of Shea type things like Banner Day and the Beatles, and I even put Joe Namath in there as part of the Shea Stadium experience. Because I wouldn't consider myself a Jets fan, if you're talking about Shea Stadium, he really was somebody that you had to know about. When you're talking about that place, and the Beatles is something you have to know, and frankly, Banner Day I think is something you have to know. You're talking about Shea because it is a quintessential Mets event that hadn't existed before and really didn't exist for any other team, and it's one of those things that got phased out by ownership that was really too bad because it was how great would it be if they were able to continue to have that at Citi Field now, but. But once they got rid of having a doubleheader between it, it really, it was going to die anyway. I mean, that, the whole thing about it was that it was in between games of a doubleheader, but, so it probably was due to die anyway. But that was one of those things that was an awful lot of fun to have gone to and glad was able to make it to a bunch of them.
Yeah, I think one of the stories that I always enjoyed hearing from my father growing up was he had been a ticket holder back in the 70s and him and some buddies had gotten together and done some banners, and he was elected not to have to go carry it. And you got to be down there in the eighth inning with the banner outside the outfield wall. And so all his buddies took the banner. They went down there in the eighth inning, game with 17.
Oh, there you go. Well, that actual that does live on because I actually have to do that next week with my kids. We're doing the, the Mr. Met Dash, the Dynamets Dash. And it's the same drill. You have to leave like in the seventh, eighth inning, and you stand around in a long line. And one time we went against San Francisco a couple years, the infamous Lasting's Millage hand slapping game with the fans, and that game went I think 13 innings, and most of which we actually left late, and we missed Millage's home run. And the only way I could tell that someone had hit a home, that it had actually gone out, was that the ushers came down and were cursing in the hall because that meant that their day was going to last even longer than ours. They at least still have the drill. It'll be interesting to see how they do it at Citi Field next week against the Reds. I can only hope it's a better feeling going into it than after this weekend.
Absolutely. So what is your story of becoming a fan, and which of these 100 things were some of the first things you experienced?
Let's see. There was I became a fan in 1975. So I missed all of the good stuff up until the mid 80s turned it around, but was there throughout the whole trading Seaver and, you know, and for years. Guys?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. I hit the button there. But in any event, so for years, 75 and 76 were like the holy grail of, you know, great Mets seasons for me of, you know, stuff I'd experienced. I mean, I knew about 69 and 73 because unlike now when they show beer money or something whenever there's a rain delay, they would actually just pop on the 73 World Series. So it's one of those things that even though I didn't experience it, I don't know that there's anything that happened that I don't know about because I saw that highlight film so many times. And 69, remarkably they didn't show quite as often, but that got a lot of play. So I always held those, you know, if I thought 75 and 76 were great years, 73 and 69 were like, you know, I wasn't worthy of even experiencing them. So I learned as much as I could about them, and that was one of the great things with Kiner, Murphy, and Nelson. They were so professional. They wouldn't, you know, I was at a party yesterday where they had the Yankees game on. And it was just, it's just so painful to, you know, I'm like sitting there, I'm like, please don't win the game. And it ended up, they won the game, and I'm the only person left in the room. You know, typical Yankees fan situation there. And, you know, I can't, you know, I'm trying to figure out what, if it's on FM or AM, and it's on Bose stereo, and I'm like, you know, hearing him, you know, go all gush on and on. But in any event, I'm rambling already, but, that I learned all my history from Kiner, Nelson and Murphy, and they also got me through the 70s, which was not easy to do. And even Lindsey Nelson bailed out a few years in, and I was, you know, have to say I was very jealous of him being able to do so.
Oh, no question about it. I mean, that is one of the luxuries that we as a franchise have had, is that, I mean, up until recently we had Murph and we had Kiner still on the air on a regular basis. And to have that luxury where we had guys who had been there since day one really being able to paint that picture for us and really delve into the team's history was always, that's a great luxury. And I don't really think I acknowledged it as much until we suddenly lost it. And luckily that we still do have Howie doing the games on the Fan, who is a diehard lifelong Mets fan. So it's still like we have that great sense of history there. And that's something that the Mets have always done on the broadcasting side that I think they've done extremely well.
Yeah, they have. And they are in very good hands with those two. And actually, Howie Rose wrote the foreword for the Mets by the Numbers book about the history of the Mets through the uniform numbers. And he was unbelievable. He came up with stuff, and we had been working on this for years. And he came up with stuff that I had no idea about. You know, a guy wearing number 41 had thrown a no-hitter in spring training. I'm like, I don't even know where I would have found that out. And it was he was truly unbelievable and did a great job and couldn't have been nicer. And Gary Cohn got to meet him once or twice, and his wife who does Gary, Keith, and Ron. Very, very nice people as well, and know their Mets, and probably hate the Yankees more than most of us out there too, which is nice to know that someone's in the booth. There's a report somebody at some point was sitting there, and when the Mets were whipping the Yankees by like 8 runs at Yankee Stadium, he was just standing there talking, you know, doing the last couple innings and waving to people as they left. Which is nice to, you know, it's keeping it professional on the air, but, you know, I'm sure he remembers, you know, I went to school when the, it was in grade school when the Yankees were winning every year, and winning the World Series every year, and the Mets had, you know, stuck with Joe Torre as a manager. And, you know, I could never root for the Yankees just because of that, and I don't think there's any circumstances that I could do that, and the team doesn't even bother me as much, but every time I think of them and they say, well, they're not so bad, I think about, you know, some kid in sixth grade, and I'm like, yeah, that's, they can't lose enough.
Absolutely, and you'll find two guys on the air right now with you who will echo those sentiments to the fullest. And actually, you bring up the Gary Keith and Ron Foundation and Lynn Cohen, who runs it. She really does do just a phenomenal job. I mentioned her on the show last week that if there's an organization that you want to get involved in and help out locally, that really is one that can do it. And they also host some of the best events ever. And I was fortunate enough to be at the event at Shea last year at the second-to-last game of the year when Johan went out and pitched a shutout against the Marlins and gave us all hope for one more day. And it was actually that event that, as I look back on it now and I've taken some time to process, that really was my best day ever at Shea Stadium. And as we're transitioning into talking about your book, Shea Goodbye, what was one of your best days ever at Shea Stadium?
Well, that's interesting you say that because I was just working on that yesterday. I have a blog, MattSilverman.com, and I actually, for the first year was last year, and that was kind of my theme. Talked about a lot of different stuff, but every couple of weeks I did my top 10, and we re-archived it so you could, you know, access them all at once. And I counted them up, and I ended up, you know, having like 35 games in there because I had a bunch of, 3A and 7A. But in the end, and I don't want to ruin any suspense for anyone going in there, but it was my first playoff game, postseason game at Shea after, you know, all those years growing up that I just elaborated on. And that first game, which turned out to be the game where Lenny Dykstra hit the home run off Houston in the bottom of the ninth, which I had never seen a game like that before, and you know, even talking about it, and it's like it's hard to not get excited about it. I mean, from a friend of mine and I who we'd gone to games throughout high school and all that, and we still go to games. Both came up from college to go to those games, and. I think we parked, and it was amazing that it's so hard to find a parking spot. And I don't know that we even spoke a word the whole walk, from way out there, out by the past the marina to into Shea, getting in there was, and I probably had the worst seats I've ever had for a Mets game too. You know, those seats in the last row of the mezzanine, which are worse than most seats in the upper deck. You could get into an argument about which seats are the worst at Shea, but the ones behind the mezzanine, you are closer to the field than some of the upper deck ones, but you just can't see anything. I mean, we had to look at Kevin Bass to decide if the ball was actually going to go out, but in the end, I think that's what made it a little more special, that you couldn't even tell, and then, looking through a bunch of people standing up to see if it was gone, and that was still pretty amazing, and I had been at the what's the game the Grand Slam single game as well, and
wow.
that was in push game and shove I put the Dykstra game ahead of that, although it was awfully close to take, and I think 2, 3, and 4 were like the Melvin Mora game, the Todd Pratt game, and the Grand Slam single game, which were like 3 weeks apart.
Wow,
and that was pretty remarkable.
Well, you had a pretty amazing run through the building.
That was
there.
A pretty good run. I'm paying for it now. But I think we all are paying a little. But that's just the way the Mets fans are. And to be honest, I go to a lot of these events, and every time I'm like, oh, you know, the spirit is broken. These people can't come back. What are they? You know, don't they have anything else? They're going on or to do and. People just come out. They just love the Mets so much. It's hard to believe. And did a couple of these things with Keith Hernandez signings that were, definitely like two of the highlights of my Mets existence. And we did one on Father's Day at Citi Field that was remarkable. And the people just, even Keith, I don't know, fully understands how much people just love him, like the cantankerous uncle. that'll never, and he won't tell you anything that, he won't feed you any BS, he'll tell it like it is, and for the most part we're able to convey that in the Shea Goodbye book as well.
No question about it.
one of the things about Keith too, I mean, is I think, you know, he makes actually, when we're losing and when we're playing like this, he's one of the few things that keeps us sane, because he does tell like it is, and quite frankly, you know, he's in some ways more entertaining to listen to on the television when the Mets are down than when the Mets are up.
Mm-hmm.
Because he does become that cantankerous uncle, and he'll complain, and he'll be basically like the fan's voice in the booth.
Yes, and yes, it is. You know, it is amazing, because he was a player, and but he really is as much a fan as either of those guys, Ronnie and Gary, and was just writing up. Just finished reading Ron Darling's book, which is also a very good read, and you know, he just does an amazing job. You know, he was like a, you know, because he'd only done 1 year of play by play, really, and they brought him in, and he was like that rookie that just he was almost like Doc, you know, just took off and couldn't be stopped, if he didn't have such a good gig here, you'd worry about him getting taken for one of the network jobs. But the way they have those set up now, the guys can actually do both.
No question.
Yeah,
about
absolutely.
It.
So how did it come together to work with Keith?
Well, we had we finished the 100 Things book, and Triumph, who I'd also worked with at, on Mets Essential, which I'd done the previous year, they. You know, I came to them and I said, I really want to work on a book on the last year at Shea. And they're like, great, but we wanted somebody that was more of a bigger name, which was, you know, understandable. And they asked me for some suggestions. And I said, well, if I was doing it, I would, I'd try Keith Hernandez. And, you know, I was like, if you can't get him, I'll give you some other names. And it took him like a month of going back and forth, and they ended up getting him, and we started working right after that. So it was, and a very hard worker on the project too. I mean, he was. We would talk at a lot of times on the road, on the phone, and from Atlanta. I must have called him like six times down there, and Miami, and you know, because he had more time. On the road, but I also, you know, was doing it when he's driving around on Long Island, picking up errands and things like that. So, so that was a lot of fun. And like, you know, I clearly knew who he was pretty well, but he didn't know me at all. He had I found out later he'd done actually some research on me, and we got along really well and were able to, go back and forth on stuff pretty well. Throughout the whole process, and we were working on it almost up until spring training, trying to get the last bits of it just the way we wanted it. So it was quite an experience.
It definitely came out as a great collaborative effort, and you guys did a remarkable job. And it's interesting when you say before about you doing the signings with him. I actually came from a background where I had 7 years working in sports memorabilia. And everyone in my company knew that I have what I like to call a healthy obsession with Keith Hernandez, not unhealthy at all. And we actually were able to grab him in and have a signing with him up in Danbury, Connecticut, and in Westport, Connecticut. So on each of those signings, I got to go up and kind of they let me sit next to him for the whole session and pick his brain. And I kind of it was interesting because he's completely candid about everything. And some of his views about the Phillies and Pat Burrell in particular at the time will be some of my most cherished, hilarious memories of Keith. Of course, none of them can be repeated on the air. But the amazing thing is when I was asking him technical baseball questions, after I would leave a signing with Keith Hernandez, I actually felt baseball smarter, if that makes sense. So I was just wondering, one, how often did you really speak to him during the season last year, and what were some of your experiences like as far as when you were talking to him, what you got out of each meeting? I mean, were these just a quick, casual, hey, Keith, what are your thoughts on the game last night, or would he get more in-depth with you as you guys spoke?
He would definitely get in depth, and we talked about. I mean, I'm trying to think one of the games. It was unfortunately to show the difference a year makes, but maybe this will have a completely different ending than last year. Last year one of the apex moments of last season was when they had that, what was it, 10-game winning streak, and a year ago they were right in the middle of it. And they had that game on the 5th or the 6th of July where they were up 9 to nothing or 7 to 1 or 9 to 1 or and they ended up winning 10 to 9. And we diagrammed that play. I think we must have spent a half an hour talking on that one where I don't even remember who got the hit anymore. But I know Eric Bruntlett tried to go from first to third and Beltran threw and the ball got away and Bruntlett scored and I don't know if it was Worth or whoever went to second base, and we diagrammed that play and how this guy, you know, he's like, Wagner did this wrong, and Wright did that wrong, and Beltran did this wrong, and Bruntlett did this wrong by running because it didn't matter if he was at third base or not. And we went over it, and I had it on tape, and we must have had like half an hour on that. But it came up, we had done it, I think, a couple days after it happened. Because then Jerry Emanuel took the team on the field, even though they won the game, and had a whole meeting with them about that play and what they did wrong and all this other stuff. And I really did feel like we had just diagrammed that whole play, and I could almost like stop it in my mind and see, you know, what was going on with it, because I had, you know, to end up writing it up, and I had the thing like running through my brain. I you know, imagined the play again like 50 times probably.
Wow! And how often would you guys actually get a chance? How often would you call Keith when you were writing the book and just to touch base with him? Were you talking to him daily or a couple times a week?
It was more like a couple times a week, sometimes three times a week. And then we kind of because at one point I wasn't sure the book was going to happen, and I have a couple of young kids, so we had, you know, vacations and things like that. So a couple of times he did not want to talk. He did not have time to talk, but he was such a pro, and I didn't want to end up, you know, we're going away. I didn't want to have it sit for a week and then come back and talk about, you know, them playing the Nationals on such and such a date, although he does keep a meticulous scorecard and can go back and, you know, conjure up any game that we would go to, but a few times that we would just kind of bang out what was needed, we talked about the Willie Randolph firing and some, you know, a few other things at length over the course of several conversations over several days.
With how the 2008 season ended, and, you know, in many ways relating to the 2007 season ending, and how, with the 100 Things book, most of us have tried to forget how those two seasons ended. And in both cases, you had to write about them. Did that affect how you felt about the way the seasons ended?
It did. I mean, we ended up going over, I went over the 2008 season probably 8 times. And, I mean, every game over the last 3 months I went over repeatedly and had to come up with something new because we were trying to get it just right. Because, like I said, Keith is a perfectionist. So I went over those games again and again. And some of them I still don't understand how they lost. And a couple of them I don't understand how they won. But there was definitely more of the former than the latter. And but I will say that one of the things that that really saved the season for me, and it makes me feel better because Keith, when people would candidly ask him, and he's not going to give you a BS answer, would say the end part of the book, which was about the ceremony at Che after that, and that, you know, by the time I left that, it brought forth so many memories of having been there, and like Craig Swan, who was you know, most people wouldn't even think of, but he pitched the first game I ever saw there, and Doug Flynn, and that somebody actually thought to bring all those guys back was remarkable. I mean, I can almost get a little bit clamped just thinking about it, that, you know, how much time I spent in the place, and we really tried to convey that. And Keith had, you know, saw him on the air, and he actually got more emotional than he ever thought he would. And he said that that was kind of the overwhelming thing. So by the time I drove home, and I had like a 2-hour drive home afterward, you know, I almost forgot them losing that last game was almost secondary. I mean, I went with four people, and three of them left after the game was over. And you know, if I am so glad that doing this project, there's no way I could have left before anyway. And plus, my car was parked so far away; it took me an hour to find it. But that really, you know, I left there thinking more about Shea than about the team. And I, you know, I really had studied that season so closely. It was just a damn shame that they couldn't pull that off, because that was one of the best season or great seasons or whatever word you want to use to compare it, because they were done. They were 7 games out. They were complete toast. The Phillies were so much better than they were. And they fired the manager. In August, they lost the 5 in a row. You know, they were playing about as poorly as they're playing now, and next thing you know, they're 3.5 games up on them. And, you know, that's what really – if they had never gotten to being in first place, I think it would have, you know, gone a lot better in their minds. And they had some amazing games. Like that Thursday night game against the Cubs was one of the best games I've ever been to at Shea, and it's completely forgotten because, you know, it just made it that much closer. But that game was remarkable, and, you know, my 25th high school reunion was that Saturday, so I missed the Johan game, if you can believe that, and was at the Friday and the Sunday games. I was was at those games and missed the Johan game, but it was a remarkable year, and you know, I think as time goes on, people will appreciate it more. I hope people will take a look at the book and, you know, take it for what it is. I mean, it's so much better than 2007, which is one of the, you know, I can't think of anything that happened in 2007 where I don't think about how the season ended. And 2008, I mean, I have so many other things to think about beyond that. Plus, you know, with a Mets fan, has been there, done that. You know, it's just a shame how that ended up, but I think, you know, it's just part of the Met pathos. You know, it's not easy. It's not going to be easy. It's never going to be easy. It's the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Red Sox rolled into one. You know, in one part it's like, wait till next year. In another part it's like, I can't believe I'm watching this and actually believing that they're going to do this and they're going to do it to me again, because they have just they've essentially rolled both of those into one at this point. And you know, they are remarkably popular all over the country. You know, which is surprisingly, because most people who aren't from here would, you know, assume that everyone from New York was a Yankees fan. But we obviously know that that's not true.
No, some of us are more intelligent and better looking. So, but yeah, it's interesting that you bring up that last day at Shea, because there was. At our website, it sparked a huge debate at the time as to whether or not they should have done the ceremony prior to the game or after the game. And I'm in agreement with you that I think doing it after the game was perfect, because it really was. We got to go from complete depression and anger over the results of the game itself, and we got to go back and reflect and kind of remember all of our favorite times and what made us Mets fans in the first place. I'll certainly go down and say that of the top 10 moments of my lifetime, probably at least 3 or 4 of them happened in that dump that some people like to call it, Shea Stadium. But I was one of those guys who, it might be a dump, but it's my dump. And I love the place. And that last day was really just emotions on so many levels. And fortunately enough, like I said, I was at the Johan game. And so I got to leave Shea Stadium with my last time ever being there, as my best time ever being there, which is just amazing. And it was my only time ever getting to sit in the bleachers, and it was something I sorely regretted not doing earlier, because it ended up being a fantastic seat and a great experience. But we are now on to the new home, and I was reading on your blog that this was your You've been there now, I believe it was 9 times, and I was just wondering what some of your thoughts about Citi Field are.
Well, it's a nice park. I mean, I was ready to really dislike it, and I was disliking it all the way up until I got inside, and I also have to confess I have a friend who's got incredibly good season tickets there as well. So we had, so I went with him and sat there, and I've been able to sit there for a couple of other games, and it's an unbelievable view. I'm going Wednesday night. I'm not sure where the seats are, but they were only $30, so I can only imagine where they are in the Will Pony and pricing guide. But it'll be interesting seeing one from, I think it's from the pretty near the top. But in general, I like it. It's I've gone there with my kids. They like it. I think there's some parts of it I don't like. I wish they had more, you know, Met stuff there, clearly, as I think most people do. And but they got it right. I the only ballparks that I think are better that I've been to, and I haven't been to all the new parks, but San Francisco and Baltimore are the only two that I can think of that I just think are better ballparks, and you know, also did it earlier. And but I, you know, PNC everybody loves. I think City, I like City Field about as much as PNC, and like as much as Citizens Bank as well. And that's you know, I hate to say it, but that is a pretty nice ballpark. But I think City Field is probably better. And I would certainly say it's better because it's a real ballpark as opposed to the wiffle ball field that they installed over there. And not talking about the one that you hit off the tee and the deep in the corner there. At City.
No, that's why, you know, again, we were talking earlier about Johan today. That was my one little worry. Left-hander pitching in that ballpark, you knew some balls were going to fly out of there, especially with Johan's lone flaw being an occasional propensity to long ball, but it doesn't help. It doesn't help that place is just a bandbox.
Yeah, that I've seen enough bad Met seasons where it wouldn't bother me so much, except, you know, you get the feeling that they're wasting the best years of Johan with just complete mediocrity here. K-Rod as well. David Wright, he's just going to have to, grin and bear it. And see what happens with the club. I mean, you would think that the team with the highest payroll in the National League could overcome some injuries or have a decent minor league system, but it's not proving to be the case.
No, absolutely not. So looking forward to the future a bit here, what's next up for you writing-wise?
Well, I had mentioned before about the 69 team being like the Holy Grail. I've been working on a book on 69 with a bunch of people, probably like 30 different writers, and we're going to put it out in the fall. I'm really hoping that we can have it done by August 22nd, which is when the Mets are doing the tribute to the 69 team. And that was another thing I thought they did a poor job on. I thought they should have had all those guys come out for the first pitch, for the, you know, to open the ballpark, or to, you know, give them more credit than they've really given them. Because that is still the most amazing team that they've ever had. I mean, the 86 team was a great team, obviously, but it is so un-Mets-like to have the best team in baseball, and then they pull one out of the rear end. I mean, the 69 team pulled one out of the rear end and then beat the best team in baseball going away, as you know, it looks like today, although every one of those games was pretty close. And they've just been, you know, doing all kinds of research on the 69 club, and the, amazing is is the operative word, and that Gil Hodge is winning with that team is still, I can't think of a better managing job in the history of the game. And I've worked on books writing about the National Association, so I can go back there, and it's they're really, I can't think of anything else. I mean, you look at that team, I mean, it's, you know, with Bobby Files and Wayne Garrett's and Al Weiss, you know, unbelievable. Worse, those guys were worse offensive players than anyone on the team now, and that's really saying something. and they managed to pull out that that world championship with Don Clendenin and a bunch of bailing wire. They also had, you know, one of the great starting rotations in franchise history, and they had Tug McGraw in the bullpen, and they didn't even use him in the World Series. And, you know, it was an amazing job, and been working on that for almost a couple of years now in between other projects, and it's just been great working on that and getting to know more and more about them every day.
No question about it, and I'll definitely be picking that up when you do release it, because like you said, that's a team. I'm a guy in my 30s, so anytime I get a chance to find out more about that team and read more about that team, and that's, I think that's one of the things SMY has actually been doing well lately, is they've been showing the 69 World Series and some of the highlights from the 73 season as well, and it's really given me a chance to kind of to fill my knowledge about those teams. So when that book comes out, we'll definitely be looking forward to it. And if people are looking for the books that are already out, and if they want to find you, and where can they go about doing it, Matt?
Well, they can, let's see, we have the Two Boots Tavern on July the 21st, which is a Tuesday, which is 6:30. Not sure exactly where it is, but it's in Manhattan. I have it written on my calendar here, and they just asked me to do that. They did a Met Stock there a few weeks ago, and this is kind of Met Stock 2, I guess. But they can also go to MetSilverman.com, M-E-T, Silverman, and they can buy signed books off there. And, of course, they can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon or even their local bookshoppy and pick one, pick any of them up there and order them if they don't have it. And we also do the Mets annual, which if you missed that and you want that, I have some copies. You can order those from the site or from Maple Street Press as well.
Well, Matt, it's certainly been a pleasure to have you with us, and we'd love to have you back when the 69 book comes out, if you wouldn't mind.
Oh, I was going to forward myself in there, so I'm glad you got me before you get my boarding house reach across there. So I would love to, and we've got to call the publisher and find out where we are, and I think we've already got 120,000 words on them. We got full biographies on everyone in there, so it's a lot of stuff, and it's a lot of fun. And also, I've been in charge of all the photos, and we have no photo budget. So I've been coming across all kinds of interesting stuff, and photos never seen before from 69, and other ones as well. So it's been a lot of fun.
Wow, that sounds fantastic, Matt. And best of luck in finishing up the project, and enjoy the Mr. Met Dash next week.
I will. I hope it's not too hot, too rainy, or too depressing, but at least the going out there. But it should be a lot of fun, and they've been playing well at Citi Field. Hopefully they'll pick this up and surprise us like they've done, you know, for 46 or so, 47 years, I guess, or so now.
Well, we appreciate your time, Matt, and we look forward to talking to you again soon. And you have a great rest of your weekend.
Hey, you too, guys. Have a great fourth weekend, or what's left of it.
All right. That's Matt Silverman joining us to talk about some of his more recent books, including Say Goodbye, The Untold Inside Story, the historic 2008 season, which was a co-write with Keith Hernandez, and he's got a list of books. I mean, if you go check him out at MettSilverman.com, you'll find that he's not just a prolific writer, he's a prolific Met writer, and he takes his love of the team and he puts it to the pen. So certainly appreciate not only a great author, but someone who obviously is a great fan of the team.
No question about it. Yeah, and he's written some phenomenal pieces about the Mets, and he was really a pleasure to talk to just there. But I got to bring something up here, because I always here in my little studio, I've got CBS on mute, and they're doing the sports highlight package, and I got to bring something up that was probably my biggest pet peeve all weekend, and that
all
is
right.
Why were the Mets wearing Phillies hats this weekend?
Everybody was wearing Phillies hats this weekend.
I did not understand this. Okay, does anybody remember post-2001, post-9/11 world, where to commemorate the United States of America, they put a nice small flag on the helmet or on the hat. But here I am looking at the Mets playing in Philadelphia wearing a bright red hat. It's bad enough that our security force at Citi Field already dresses like the Phillies. You don't need to make our players dress like them.
Well, I think, you know, I think that we got to chalk this one up to our dear friend Bud Selig. And the fact that the idea behind it, of course, is cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. I mean, you really can't sell that. You cannot sell a whole lot of souvenir baseball caps. And don't get me wrong, it's for a great cause. It's absolutely for a great cause. I am not questioning the cause. It's for to support soldiers coming back from war. You cannot fault that one whatsoever. But simply marketing hats with little baseball, or a little American flag on the back of the hat is not going to move the kind of coinage that a bright red with hat with a stars and stripes, or at least in the case of the Blue Jays, you know, the maple leaf in the middle of it. You know, it's certainly not going to move that kind of coinage. So I understand it. Do I think they look hideous? Absolutely. It doesn't hurt that in the past they've done blue caps, which certainly are more with our quote-unquote motif. I think that there is something you could do, I mean, that would be, you know, more, I mean, I don't see why you can't do some sort of special hat in the respective team's colors. I mean, the reality of it is when they did the blue hats, it was a kick in the face to every team who doesn't wear blue. This year, it was a kick in the face to everyone who doesn't wear red. The only ones that looked good in it were Cincinnati, St. Louis, and Philadelphia, really, and, you know, on a good day, the Red Sox. Otherwise, it all kind of looked a wee bit weird, to be perfectly honest. And again, I don't want to fault whatsoever the cause, because I don't want to sound like I'm deriding the cause that Major League Baseball was behind, not just the soldiers this weekend, but also the Lou Gehrig's disease fundraising that went on with the patches on the uniforms this weekend as well. So I don't want to sound like I'm deriding charity, because if there's one thing, the Happy Recap, that we are big supporters of are charities. We really believe in that as a website. But it still looked goofy.
it did. And I think that Bud just declaring his allegiance to the Bloods is just a slap in the face of all Crips out there.
Oh, man, you had to play the gang card.
No doubt. But you're right. Yeah, we're a big fan. We support. And I think that Major League Baseball, they did a fantastic job with the Lou Gehrig's disease. And it's interesting you bring that up. I was watching the Fox pregame on Saturday, and they did a phenomenal piece about the Gehrig retirement speech that was just a goosebump moment. So Major League Baseball had a great weekend as far as charitable giving goes and as far as awareness goes, but they had an awful weekend as far as fashion goes.
Absolutely. And as we discussed in one of the threads on the forum this week, which I can't really describe the thread too much because it was so visual. But go to thehappyrecap.com and check out the ugly uniforms through the years thread. It's absolutely a classic. Although I'm still disappointed that one of our younger members blasphemed the Mets and posted a picture of Jesse Orozco from 1986. That just hurt my soul right there.
All I'll say about those 86 uniforms is when the Mets wore them, I guess it was back around 2001, 2002, they wore them in a throwback day, that even Mo Vaughn looked like a baseball player in that uniform. So that right there
Absolutely.
Speaks volumes about it.
And just for those of you listening to the live feed, we're going to go underground here, and you'll be able to catch the rest on the podcast. Make sure you switch over to 7 Train to Shea. They'll be talking more about the Mets' woes, and I'm sure those woes are more than enough to carry on into our good friend Mike Silva and Harrah Megdal coming up at 8 on Blog Talk Radio. Triple header, as always, on a Sunday night, a good way to wrap up your 4th of July weekend. We'll continue here for a little while longer, but for those of you listening to the live cast, be sure to go switch over to that and then come back and download us via Blog Talk Radio or iTunes, however you choose to do it. And for those of you who are departing, we'll talk to you later, but we'll be continuing on as we talk about the 86 uniforms and other weird uniforms. The one thing I thought was funny about the 86 uniforms when we did that throwback is they found a little magic back in them. They were slumping at that point, and I think they actually wound up wearing those uniforms an extra day or two because they found themselves in a mini winning streak.
Yeah, no question. I think, if I remember right, Fonzie hit something like around 400 when he wore that uniform. And there was a movement at the time to make that a permanent addition to the uniforms. And it's ironic, as we're talking about it right now, I'm looking at four autographed pictures that I keep in my studio here of Daryl, one of Keith, one of Gary Carter, and, of course, another one of Keith, all in those uniforms. And I got to say, man, those are sharp. And they're still rocking the old stirrups, which was great to see back in the day. I'd love them to bring that uniform back.
Oh, absolutely. I have no problem with that uniform. You know, a little modern upgrade. I don't think they'd really want to wear the polyester anymore. You know, rocking the
no,
polyester is not really all that good. I mean, they got rid of it for a reason. The question I have for you, I was thinking about this earlier today, and I don't get to see every game being out here on the West Coast, but I can't remember lately having seen those horrific black uniforms at all lately. Is it just me, or have they vanished?
They got rid of the black with the I believe it's the one, the black with the Mets across it, and they kept the black with the New York across it, or it's vice versa. I forget which one, but I agree with you. I cannot stand the black uniforms. It's not an official team color. I don't care when they want to tell me that they adopted it as an official team color. It's not. And I personally, I am one of those guys who's of the belief that if we're playing inside of almost called the Shea, City Field, it should be pinstripes and blue caps at all times.
See, I'm a little bit different. Here's I don't get me wrong. I am a traditional Mets fan. I like the blue cap. I like the pinstripe orange. At the same time, you look at the origins of the Met uniform, and I actually don't mind the Snow Whites, what they call the Snow White alternates. And the reason is this. The blue is from the Dodgers. The orange is from the Giants. The pinstripes are the Yankees. That was how that uniform was put together. And I don't mind it if we occasionally leave the Yankees out of the equation.
Understandable, but to me, the all whites, they're always going to be what I refer to as the pajamas.
You know, and it's funny, if you look at that thread on the happyrecap.com, you'll find a couple that actually look even more like pajamas. And there was, you know, through Bill Veeck and the and his wonderful world, at some point during our offseason when we expand our horizons a little bit and look around baseball, I think I'd like to bring in somebody who's an expert on Bill Veeck, because, my gosh, what an interesting person. You know, some of the uniforms he put his White Sox through are just unbelievably weird.
One of them
looked like, one set looks like pajamas, another set looks like an NBA team could have wore it with the shorts and all.
Yeah, the shorts were definitely probably the worst idea in the history of Major League Baseball uniforms, and that includes anything the Pirates have attempted in the past few years. I think the only thing that might actually be worse was the future uniforms, where we were the Mercury Mets. And,
forward day. Oh, that was awful.
Which all originated, if you remember, it all originated with the Mariners, and it was a one-day event that was just absolutely miserable, and every player looked ridiculous, that Major League Baseball decided to make it an entire league-wide event. And so we ended up with the Mercury Mets. And what's amazing is I believe that Major League Baseball has internet snipers, because I went on a quest one day to try to find a picture of a Mercury Mets jersey, and usually you just punch it into Google, quick Google images, and bam, there it is. It took me at least 20 minutes of scouring the internet before I finally found a great picture of Brett Saberhagen in his Mercury Mets jersey.
I tell you, you know, you're thinking of Oral Hershiser, though. But,
you're right, it was Oral. It wasn't Brett.
But, you know, I question a lot of things that Major League Baseball does, including some of the stunts they pull on websites. But if that's something they've actually done and gone through and pulled out those, gotten people to pull down those pictures, God bless Bud Selig. those were atrocious uniforms. And I remember when I heard about the promotion thinking, okay, I'm open-minded to this. This could be kind of cool. Maybe I'll buy, you know, maybe I'll buy a shirt or something like that.
Yeah, no doubt. Yep.
And then I saw them, and I went like, oh, I can't even force myself to buy this ugly thing. And I'm one of the people that actually went out in, what, 96 or whatever it was, or whatever season it was, and got when the Snow White uniforms came out. Remember the Snow White hat they had for that one year, for first year of the Snow Whites?
Unfortunately, I do remember that hat. And
I'll
just tell you right now,
one.
you and I are close, and you're like a brother to me, but if I ever see you wearing that hat, we're throwing down, brother.
You know, the thing is, to this day, I think I probably wore it a couple times that season, and it's sat in a box ever since. But I do actually own one, and, you know, had it Had it actually stayed in the uniform, I probably would have worn it occasionally, but it is not by any means a hat of choice these days. Don't worry. We need not throw down, dear brother.
What's funny is actually one of my most cherished items was it's a John Franco baseball card where he is in the all-white pajama uniform with the white hat that I got John to sign at a game that I saw him outside, and he signed it really quick for me. But that was like one of my most cherished items, and I was going through a lot of my memorabilia recently, and I came across that, and I just took one look at that hat and just started dying laughing and said, what were they thinking? I mean, who came up with that? Is this the same guy who thought playing Sweet Carolina at Citi Field was a good idea?
I have, you know, the funny thing is, for whatever reason, and don't ask me why, every time I think of that hat, the only player I can actually picture in it is Masato Yoshi. Don't ask me to explain that.
Hey, Masato Yoshi in the season of his amazing Subway Series start that will make him always get him a place of great love in my heart for Masato because of that one start that he had. And we had a lot of guys who were like that. Dave Malicki had the one great start against the Yanks. And of course, Mr. Koo was another one who his number one moment was the Subway Series moment. So, yeah, that's funny that you think of him. And whenever I hear Masato, I just think of that one start against the Yanks.
Absolutely. I mean, it's hard not to. Turning away from uniforms, though, as we get ready to wrap things up, should be an interesting week in the world of the Mets. Hopefully we don't give Jerry Manuel too many more reasons to laugh. You know, certainly this new Chuckles Manuel is not really to my liking, to be honest. I understand what he's trying to do. I understand that he's trying to downplay things. At the same time, to me, it makes it look like he's not taking his job seriously.
No question about it. And I have recently, and I got to give SMY credit, they've been doing a much better job with their post game lately, where they're really sticking around for a while, making sure we hear from every guy that we want to hear. And I've really gotten into watching Jerry's post game because, of course, it hasn't been good. And I took to Twitter the other night even saying that I'm getting the popcorn ready for the post game. And unfortunately, that was before the game was even over, but we all knew that it was only a matter of time at that point. But Jerry just comes out there and he does his stand-up. He does stick. And as he's doing his shtick, usually the beat writers are all laughing like hyenas, like what he's saying is the funniest thing. Well, a couple problems with it. One, it's mildly funny. I mean, this isn't Richard Pryor back in 82. It's mildly amusing what he's saying. There's no reason for the guffaws like these guys were giving him. And two, you're coming off an awful losing streak, and you're coming off a game where you probably just dropped another game in the standings. The fans of the team are screaming doom and gloom, and we're basically all completely frustrated. I don't want to see my manager going in there and laughing. He actually laughed about Johan's start in Milwaukee where he got beaten up. He said, oh, well, Johan should be fresh for his next start because he only pitched a couple innings last time. Ah, ha, ha, ha. At this point, that was the turning point for Jerry because not a single beat writer laughed with him. So I think they've actually reached the point now where they're more frustrated than our own damn manager is about the lack of everything with this team.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and the thing about it is I've been noticing amongst the beat writers, I mean, you know, we follow a lot of them, and you know, for most of the fans, it's worth signing up for a Twitter account just to follow the Mets beat writers. If you don't have one, think about doing it for just that reason. EJ's rant during a Sunday afternoon game. I tell you, I was enjoying those today, watching the Happy Recap account going.
I was a little fuego today.
You're a little punchy, to say the least.
Yeah, my favorite one of the day was, did Joe Blanton just ask a fan in the first row if he wants to throw a few no-hit innings?
Yeah, I saw. just to put out the disclaimer, the views and opinions of EJ do not necessarily reflect those of the site.
I got the password.
Bye.
Yeah, I was having a lot of fun with it today. And you know what? That's the only way you can deal with what's been going on lately. Sometimes maybe you got to take to the internet. You got to take to the Happy Recap. Luckily, we have this show, which is my weekly therapy. But you got to take it all in good humor, and that's what I try to do with our Twitter account. I try to take it all in tongue-in-cheek and have a good time with it.
Well, and the good thing is, and I forgot to congratulate Matt for this when he was with us earlier about going to the game on Wednesday. If we need no other good news about this week, it's knowing that Oli Perez is starting on Wednesday.
I can't believe that when I heard that news, I was happy. JB, I mean,
I know.
We were calling it the O word earlier in the season, and when I heard that Redding's out of the rotation, thank God, and Oli was coming back, I actually said to myself, oh, good, Ollie's back. And then it dawned on me about 3 seconds later, wait, what did I just say?
Yeah, it certainly is one of those things. And the kicker is, as far as Redding goes, I mean, if he continues to be what I think he can be, and that's an effective 2-3 inning guy, I think he can actually be a valuable member of this team. I just think he was ill-placed to be in the rotation. The guy is not a starter. And I think he's proved that. But, I mean, if you look at him, you know, most of his starts, he's effective through about the first 4 innings.
Yep.
And I think that's all you can ask for. I mean, if you've got a guy who can come in a blowout or situation type thing where bad Ollie shows up or something like that and mop it up by, you know, going scoreless for 4 innings or allow 1 or 2 runs and maybe the Mets get into the ballgame, I think Redding earns his paycheck.
No question. I think he's a fantastic long man for us to have. I think he will be a weapon out of the bullpen in case Ollie comes back and bad Ollie does show up. I think he's a great option for us to have, and you're right. He's not a rotation guy. If you remember at the beginning of the season, it was him versus Levon for the 5th spot. Well, Levon won, and Redding was set to be in the bullpen. But similarly, it's going to bring up another issue when Maine gets back. We've got Fernando Nieves out there who has not looked good in his last few starts. And what are you going to do with a guy like him when John Maine comes back?
Well, I think with Nieves, I think it depends on how he does his next couple starts out. I mean, I think he'll probably get 2 or 3 more starts before Maine is ready. I think
John Maine was only a couple days away, and then he got put back on the shelf for a few months, as seems to be the case with the majority of this team.
You know, it's one of those things. Again, with Maine, I think I was talking about it last week. I just don't know who to blame in that situation because Maine's a gamer. My guess is he was not being forthright with how much he was still hurt. But, you know, again, we're not on the inside of those trainers' walls, so we don't know for sure. But I still – Maine's a gamer. He's going to come back as soon as he can. I just hope not at his own peril.
Yeah, no question about it. No question about it that – Just get healthy, John, and come back in August. And it brings up a very interesting question as to a lot of people are saying that what Omar's doing is the right thing as far as standing pat and just waiting for the reinforcements to get healthy. And I kind of agree with that as far as going out and acquiring a bat. As much as I'd love to see a guy like Adam Dunn here, as much as I would have loved to have seen a guy like DeRosa here, I understand Omar standing pat. But Omar does know that Beltran and Reyes and Delgado, none of them pitch, right? Because that still is going to be a big question mark, even with a healthy Ollie and a healthy John Maine back in the rotation.
Well, the thing that should also be pointed out, though, is, I mean, over the last week, I mean, you look at the Mets, I mean, the pitching has been the strongest aspect. I mean, even Nieve in his weak start the other night against Philadelphia, I mean, you're looking at a situation where, you know, with him, he left the Mets in a position where in a good, healthy Met team, they're still in a position to win. It was essentially a quality start. I think that you look at the Mets pitching, and I don't think that they're as desperate as it seems. Most of these games they're losing are not blowouts. Very few of them are. And I think that, while – I think the biggest problem is there's no intimidation in the lineup whatsoever because you've got, as far as a home run threat, you've got Gary Sheffield,
yep.
And Gary Sheffield, and occasionally Brian Schneider. You know, I mean, and that's how pathetic. I mean, because, you know, the fact of the matter is I think, I think I was looking, Daniel Murphy – has as many home runs as David Wright does at this point. And I think we all agree that Daniel Murphy's pretty much stinking up the great outdoors at this point.
Absolutely. Fernando Tatis actually has double the double plays than David Wright has home runs right now. So you're right. There's a complete power outage that we have going on with this lineup. And you're right. There is no intimidation factor. But, and when Reyes comes back, I mean, he's not really a thumper. Beltran comes back. Hopefully he has the power stroke. And Delgado, who knows? But it brings up an interesting question. And we did this with the Yankee Stadium series. You and I predicted the homers the Mets would hit. So let's do the who's back first. Reyes, Beltran, and Delgado, who do you have coming back off the DL first?
Oh, that's close. I think Delgado is the furthest out of the three of them. I'm going to go with I think Beltran is back first. And to be perfectly honest, I'm just rolling the dice between. I'm not using anything scientific to determine that, other than a bone bruise is a lot more. It's a lot easier to watch than necessarily all the various problems that Mr. Reyes has going on with him. So I think the chance of re-injury on a rehab process is certainly less for Beltran than it is for Reyes. So I'm going to go with Beltran, but barely.
I'm going to throw the wrench into the spokes here, and I'm saying it's Delgado, simply for the reason. For as soon as he hit the DL, they said to us it's going to be at least 10 weeks, if not more. With Reyes and Beltran, it's a couple more days and they'll be back, and then next thing you know, they're on the DL for a few more months. At least with Delgado, they've been open and honest about his status, and I'm going to bet that Reyes will once again be days away and have some type of setback in Florida that will put him on the shelf for another 2 weeks, 3 weeks, something like that. So I'm going to, in this poll, I am going to pick Delgado to be the first regular Met that we see back on the field.
All right, that's a fair choice. And we'll give Reyes to Ryan in default since he's not here to defend himself or make the pick, so he gets assigned Reyes in this whole thing. But I certainly think that in what we're talking about with the lineup, you look at what we got on the shelf with the three of those players on there. And I think even, David Wright's still getting some base hits, although albeit he is in a horrendous slump right now, and he just seems to slump for 10 days, then hit like a maniac for 10 days. And I'm just, again, when all is said and done, I do not understand the 2009 season for David Wright at all. But the thing with Wright is that you put Delgado, Beltran, and Reyes back in the rotation when he's getting those base hits and not those home runs. Those guys are actually scoring then. Right now, when Wright does hit, there ain't nobody on the base.
Yeah, that's a huge problem right now, that he really is the only major league professional hitter in that lineup. And that's no disrespect to guys like Gary Sheffield, just Sheffield's not in that lineup on a daily basis. And Brian Schneider's not exactly a real thumper. It seems like Wright's coming up to the plate a lot of times, that it's either – if he does have a man out, it's two outs and there's a guy on first, or he's coming up to the plate with the bases empty. And it's just problematic, but I think you just hit the nail on the head when you said, I don't understand 2009 David Wright. I don't understand the 2009 New York Mets. It's a situation where between injuries and everything else that we have going on and guys not playing fundamental baseball and our manager is auditioning for Night at the Improv, and it's just been a very weird year. And as we hit the 81-game point today, we're halfway done with it. I honestly couldn't even begin to tell you where we're going to be after the next 81 games. If you told me that we're going to win the division by 10, running away with it in September, I could make a case to justify that. If you're going to tell me that we're going to fall down to the Nationals level and we're going to finish the season 15 out, I can make a strong case for that too. So it's really, this has been one of the most perplexing seasons that I can remember in a while as a Met fan.
I said the only one that comes close in my mind and my memory, and this is having to go way back in the memory decks, is 1987. And I'll keep saying that one until I turn blue in the face. That's the only thing I can even come close to this reminding me of. It's a bizarre season. I expect more bizarre things. We got another player heading for the MRI, at least, maybe not the disabled list, with Fernando Martinez going to be checked out tomorrow in New York for what sounds like a knee injury there as well. It certainly is a situation where, he may be the next person on the disabled list, and that would put us at a nice round 10, a nice even number for all involved. We may get Angel Pagan back in the next week. That would be nice. But certainly it's a situation where there's just so much, Met fans want so desperately to blame somebody, and people are blaming Omar, they're blaming Jerry, they're blaming Ray Ramirez. I don't think there's one person at fault for all of this. But it certainly, if this team continues to go down the proverbial crapper for the rest of the season, I think that there are definitely changes to be made, and I think that those changes, everything has to be on the table short of trading, David Wright and or Johan Santana, and to a good extent I would put K-Rod on that list as well. But I think that those options do include firing Jerry, firing the coaching staff, firing Omar. Not saying that these are moves that should be made. I'm just saying everything should be on the table.
No question about it, bro. No question at all. I mean, I totally agree with everything you just said. I agree with the three non-tradable players. Everyone else on the roster would be up for grabs, and I agree that Omar wouldn't be the one who gets to drop the axe on another manager. He would have the axe dropped on himself. I believe that the players would need a different voice out there other than Jerry, and that basically going into 2010, we would have to have a completely fresh approach as a franchise as to what our goals are and what we hope to accomplish. But, excuse me, hopefully this is all for moot. Hopefully come first week of October, we're sitting here doing our show on a Sunday night and we're talking about our first round matchup because these guys were able to right the ship. And hopefully they, with the reinforcements coming back, they end up going on a absolute tear. I mean, come on, we have the most all-stars of any National League team. That's
which is unreal to me.
That is just shocking that we have four all-stars and it's the most of any NL team, and we're a team that's not even sitting at 500 right now.
Well, that's one thing next week that we'll be talking about, of course, with the next Sunday being the last day before the All-Star break. We'll take a comprehensive look back at the first half of the season. Guest-wise, we're still working on that, but hopefully we'll have that sorted out in the next day or so. Coming up, also, we will be rescheduling with Phil Pepe, who was supposed to join us last week. He'll be joining us in the next couple weeks, so stay tuned for that. I want to remind you that on the 19th, 2 weeks from today, our show will be 1 hour early due to the early start time on Sunday Night Baseball for the Mets. And next week we'll talk a little bit about our All-Stars. We'll talk some first half baseball. Hopefully we won't need the crying towels too much. Like I said, we've got Ollie coming in, so we'll see how he does. I'm sure we'll have plenty to say about that appearance in the rotation for Mr. Perez. And any closing thoughts, EJ?
Nah, just hope to see it all turn around this this week and maybe see some signs of life and some signs of good fundamental baseball, and hope everyone had a very happy and safe 4th of July weekend, and can't wait to talk to you all again Sunday night.
Absolutely. I want to thank again our guest, Matt Silverman. Check him out at Met Silverman, M-E-T as in Mets, MetSilverman.com, and be sure to read all his books. They're all good stuff. We'll certainly enjoy having him back talk about the 69 Mets in the future. In fact, with the 40th anniversary this year, working on a few guests on that, so we'll be having some shows coming up. We'll be working on talking about some 69 Mets, especially as we get into the off season. We want to give them their due. It's been 40 years, and by all means, that was the year that defined this franchise. For everything that we say about 1986, that was a team built to win. The 1969 Mets are the team that never should have. So. We'll gladly offer them tribute and hopefully maybe even talk to one or two of the members of the team. So we'll be talking 69 Mets as the sun returns to fall, and hopefully we'll be talking about another set of miracle Mets that have somehow turned around a world of injuries. Made a decent season out of 2009. So we appreciate you listening. Make sure you check us out, thehappyrecap.com, twitter.com/thehappyrecap, and we'll join you next week at 6 for another edition of the Happy Recap Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio.
See ya.